Mr. Schultz, you are here by video?
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right. And can you hear us okay?
I can. Thank you.
All right. If there are any problems, Mr. Schultz, you just let us know. And so whenever you are ready, Mr. Schultz, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Benjamin Schultz, on behalf of the United States, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay. Please keep track of your time.
Sure. Your Honor, the district court in this case concluded that even though the Fourth Amendment was entered into in September 2011, and even though entering into the Fourth Amendment was the very breach of contract and breach of fiduciary duty that the United States was suing over, nonetheless, the government's claims accrued before that breach ever occurred.
Counsel, that I have was wrong. A question I hope you can help me with.
Sure.
The condition precedent here of approval by the government of the Fourth Amendment was plainly not met. I don't think that's an issue. There are various ways that a condition precedent can be waived under New York law, which was the choice of law in the contract. And I'm trying to figure out whether it can be waived and whether it has been waived. I suppose one way would be a subsequent agreement not to enforce. There's a problem there because there's an anti-waiver clause in the lease. Another thing that I don't know quite what it means. There's a letter at excerpts of record 336 from the county manager to the government where they send the $147,000, and it's a little hard to interpret that, and I'm trying to figure out whether that turns into a waiver of the condition precedent. Help me.
Sure. And, Your Honor, let's start at the top. Actually, I think everybody agrees that this contract is interpreted under Nevada law rather than New York law.
Why?
I don't think anyone's ever said
it's got a choice of law clause in it that says New York law. I never understood why everybody was looking to Nevada law.
Your Honor, I'm not familiar with that. I don't think anyone's ever cited that, and the defendants have agreed with us that
Nevada law applies. I thought it had that choice of law provision in the contract. You have the contract right in front of you, I imagine.
I do. Are you saying the Fourth Amendment has a choice of law provision that makes Nevada law apply? New York law apply instead of Nevada law?
Did I confuse this case with the next one? It's possible, I suppose. Well, go ahead. It is possible. Go ahead with the interpretation of the
go back to the lease?
Go ahead and talk about the letter.
Sure. Yeah. So I'm happy to explain why the conditions precedent don't apply here. So there are conditions precedent in the lease. I think one of the first questions the court has to ask is which provisions of the lease are subject to the conditions precedent, because there's no dispute that the parties agreed that the entire lease was effective. There's no dispute that even the provision about conditions precedent says that some provisions are subject to the conditions precedent and some aren't. So then the question is which ones are subject to the conditions precedent. The defendant's argument is that section 1.6, which is the new rent provision, is subject to the conditions precedent. The problem with that is that is in direct conflict with section 1.6 itself, which says that it is effective on the approval date, which is the date that was entered into.
Well, counsel, it certainly says that, but let me quote from paragraph 36 of your complaint. BLM's express written approval of the Fourth Amendment was a condition precedent to most of the Fourth Amendment's terms, including the new rent provision. So that's what you alleged. Spoiler alert, I'm going to ask the other side because their answer said you're wrong. But you wrote in your complaint that this was a condition precedent to the new rent provision. So doesn't that, at the very least, isn't the lease at the very least ambiguous under Nevada law. If you have to look at parole, it's for the trier of fact. So isn't this issue for the trier of fact?
So, Your Honor, it may well be for the trier of fact. I think we don't think it's ambiguous because of the specificity. So as a matter of Nevada law, one thing you can do just looking at the plain text is apply the provision, the specific governs the general. Here, the general provision is the general conditions precedent provision.
But counsel, there are two specifics. So I agree with you that one of the specifics is the rent provision takes effect on the approval date. And there's no question the approval date took place. But 1.6 also has this list of terms. 1.2 also has this list of terms that the remaining section shall not be operative until the condition precedent date, until the effective date, which never occurred. So why aren't those both specific?
Well, it has to do with the level of specificity. So even if you think it's specific as to 1.6, and you'll see that 1.6 isn't a specific term mentioned. Instead, it gives a bunch of lists and then says everything else is subject to the condition precedent. Well, 1.6, so I don't agree
that's
that
pretty it's specific, isn't it?
That's pretty specific. 1.6 is in the everything else.
Right. It's in the everything else. But even more specific than everything else is 1.6 itself, which is just about the new rent. And
well,
so
let me ask you this.
1.6,
if we do find that there's an ambiguity, does it have to go to a jury trial? If it goes in front of a jury, what is the evidence and what is the jury supposed to determine?
Sure. Well, if the court thinks that there is an ambiguity, we think all of the extrinsic evidence favors the idea that it was immediately effective. So the first thing you have is the drafting history. In the August 2011 version, Section 1.6 said that it would take effect on the effective date. And then the parties intentionally and specifically changed it. They wrote in, instead of taking effect on the effective date, it would take effect on the approval date. Then you have the course of performance. It's undisputed that the county was billing Nevada Lynx under the Fourth Amendment. It was sending invoices.
When they said approval date, I thought approval date meant approval by the BLM.
No, approval date as defined under the contract was the date that the county board approved the contract, which was September 6, 2011, the effective date was the date that all of the conditions precedent, including Interior's approval, was met.
And as I understand it, that we know that the BLM approval as one of the conditions precedent was never met, right?
That's correct. BLM
and,
did not approve
and
this.
The zoning condition was never met either, right?
That's correct. That wasn't, as far as anyone can tell, that was also not met.
Yeah, I didn't see anything in the record about whether the lender condition was met.
Look, I'm agreeing with you that all of the parole evidence that I've seen supports your construction. And so if we get past the limitations issue, then what do we have to try the case? I didn't see an argument from you other than it's unambiguous and therefore we win as a matter of law. What if it is ambiguous? Can you still win as a matter of law?
So, Your Honor, I'm not sure that there would be any fact questions. We move for summary judgment on liability. We think it is clear that we're entitled to summary judgment that this provision was in effect, and we think that there are no material factual disputes because all of the extrinsic evidence points in one direction.
There is a material factual dispute, counsel. There's a material factual dispute about whether this provision is effective on the approval date or the effective date. And as I read Nevada law says if you have, as I understand it, but correct me if I'm wrong here, because you both argued the lease is unambiguous. But my understanding of Nevada law is if you have to resort to any parole except trade usage, which is not applicable here. But if you have to resort to any parole, then it's for the trier of fact. Are you aware of any Nevada case which says that you can A, resort to parole other than trade usage, and B, still determine the meaning of the contract as a matter of law?
I cannot cite a Nevada case to the court that stands for that proposition. But what I do want to point out is that you have one additional fact here, which is that in 2014, the county and Nevada Lynx jointly filed an estoppel certificate. So certainly as to 2014, even if you thought the contract was originally ambiguous, from 2014 onward, we don't see how there's any remaining ambiguity because they both, as a matter of law, agreed amongst themselves.
Isn't an estoppel certificate parole?
Well, Your Honor, I think the point is, at a minimum, even if you thought that the original agreement had not been immediately effective, as of 2014, there would have been a modification of that agreement. And we noted in our reply brief that if that was the interpretation, it's clear that as of 2014, they modified the agreement when they followed the estoppel certificate. But I don't want to belabor the point. I think at the end of the day, you know, whether or not you think it's clear as of 2014 or whether or not you think it's clear as of 2011, at an absolute minimum, the district court was incorrect to grant summary judgment. We think there's a lot of evidence here that shows that it's evident, this contract...
It's evident from our questions to you, I suppose, that we're not accepting the treatment of it as kind of an installment agreement where the statute embraces the last six payments. None of our questions would seem to assume that. Can you get us back to what this letter that the county sent to the government with the payment of $147,000 means?
Yeah, we think that that's the county admitting to the United States that the Fourth Amendment was effective when it was entered into in 2011. That's because the county sends all of these payments that it collected from 2013 to 2016, and it says we've been collecting them because the Fourth Amendment has been in effect, and we're going to continue to collect them.
Yeah, but counsel, I mean, again, I agree that's a pretty clear letter. It's parole, but I mean, if you look at ER 529 on September 13th, 2011, the county, the Department of Aviation, sent a letter that said the ground lease amendment is conditioned upon express written approval of the BLM. So, I mean, they sent different letters saying different things, just like your complaint and their answer take opposite positions than you're taking now. Isn't that all, like, thrown into the mix as, wow, we better let a trier of fact sort this out?
And Your Honor, if the court thinks that all of this creates an issue of fact, then you know we'll fight that out in the district court.
So I recall, there's a Nevada case. Let's see, what was the name of it? Don't seem to have it handy right now. But there was a Nevada case that says if the contract is ambiguous, it's not just. I think it's UDEVCO versus Wagner. It doesn't just let in extrinsic evidence the way ambiguity often does. It also means that the case should be given to a jury. Is that right?
Your Honor, if
you're not fighting us on that, are you?
I'm not. At the end of the day, we're here on an appeal from a grant of summary judgment to the defendants, and our position is that summary judgment should not have been granted to the defendants.
So you're happy enough if we send it back for a jury trial?
I think actually in this case, no one has demanded a jury trial. It might be a bench trials, but either way, our position is that summary judgment should not have been granted to the defendants.
So, counsel, I want to slightly change focus with hopefully like a more practical question. So
Sure. As
I understand the plaintiff's position, their legal position, which is sort of part two of their alternative arguments, is that what the lease really provided is that both fixed rent and participatory rent have, they say the rent provision never came into effect. But they say alternatively, even if it did come into effect on the approval date, both fixed rent and participatory rent were simultaneously in effect. You understand that's their position, right?
That is the county's position.
Yes,
I think Nevada Links takes a different position.
And I understand. But if they're right on that, then there's no breach, right? If you're getting – the United States agrees that if you get both participatory and fixed, there's no breach, right?
I think it becomes a much more complicated issue if we're getting both, whether or not there is or is not breach.
Well, but you've argued participatory without fixed is not a breach, right?
So had you not entered into the Fourth Amendment at all, then we have not in this case challenged the idea that the original 1999 lease, based on the information available in 1999, was at fair market value.
I'll ask your friends this question too. But if they're saying you theoretically are getting both participatory rent and fixed rent, And if in the United States' view, at least hypothetically, that that wouldn't be a breach, and if it looks like this case could be set back for trial, wouldn't you think that there's some grounds here that you and your friends could possibly come to some agreement without having to send this case back for trial, which is going to be expensive and time-consuming for everybody?
Your Honor, we're always in the mood. We're always willing to talk with people about resolution. You know, we're, if the court thinks it would be helpful, we can certainly continue discussions.
I would urge you and your friends to think about whether or not we have excellent mediators in the Ninth Circuit. And I mean, we're not going to send this case to mediation unless both parties want it to be. But I urge you and counsel for the other side to consider this. And if you both think that mediation might be helpful, within a week after submission of this case, sort of send us a communication. And I'm sure we would be happy if both parties wanted this to go to mediation to refer it. But it sounds like there might be a way the parties could find some common ground, especially if this case is heading back for trial.
Your Honor, we will let the court know within a week if we think that further mediation would be fruitful.
I have something else I want to ask you. I think you might be selling yourself too short, and there might be a shorter way out of this case. Let's assume that Nevada law says if there's an ambiguity, you got to have a trial. That may be a function of the fact that it hasn't come up in Nevada that all the evidence points one way, as you argue, with regard to the approval versus effective date. And shouldn't we be applying the Rule 56 standard rather than Nevada law on that point? So that if all the evidence does point one way, no reasonable jury could find in favor of your adversary anyway, why don't we rule on it as a matter of law, just like the district court would do it, even if Nevada law hasn't gotten there yet?
That's exactly right, Your Honor. And I think that's that, and I apologize if I wasn't clear before, that I think I was trying to give that argument that we think all the extrinsic evidence points in one way. So even if you thought there was ambiguity and you had to then look to extrinsic evidence, that extrinsic evidence then tells you how to resolve this.
But,
and we
but
agree
counsel,
that you would apply as a procedural matter.
Counsel, both of you argued to the district court that the contract was clear as a matter of law, correct?
Our position was that we were entitled to summary judgment on liability. That's correct.
Okay. And their position was also that the contract was clear, right?
They thought that. That's correct.
So no one claimed that the contract was ambiguous and that the extrinsic evidence commanded summary judgment nonetheless, right? Nobody made that argument to the district court, right?
Well, Your Honor, in our summary judgment papers, when they defended against our motion for summary judgment, we explained that we were entitled to summary judgment, and we explained that, you know, number one, the contract is clear, but number two, as a matter of Nevada law, if there was ambiguity, you could look to extrinsic evidence. So in support of summary judgment, I believe we did make the argument that the extrinsic evidence was a further reason why we were entitled to summary judgment.
An alternative argument.
Correct, yes, as an alternative.
All right,
you're
down to about 2 minutes. Would you like to reserve, and we'll give you a little bit of extra time for your rebuttal?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor.
All right. All right, whenever you're ready, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'm Jonathan Harden, and I represent the defendant, County of Clark. Before I get started, I think the site you were looking for Nevada law is Gilardi versus Naples Polaris, which is 129 Nevada 306, which says if there is an ambiguity requiring extrinsic evidence to discern the party's intent, then summary judgment is improper.
Wasn't there evidence going both ways in that case? Wasn't there parole going both ways?
So, Your Honor, I think the Fourth Amendment is certainly creative. We think it's clear. The extrinsic evidence that the government points to, we think, goes to the question of whether or not there was a modification of the contract. So we submit that the Fourth Amendment itself is actually clear and unambiguous while creative, and that it allowed for risk-free payments to be made by the county while the parties tried to satisfy the conditions precedent. But it But the language is clear that Section 1.6 does not become legally operative, meaning that it does not displace the participatory rent term in the original lease unless or until all three conditions precedent are met.
Okay, and well, counsel, let me sort of press back a little on that point. So if you could take a look at Section 1.6.2.1, if you have that there. The last paragraph, do you see that?
Yes.
And it starts with the rental shall begin on the approval date. Do you see that paragraph?
I do.
And then it has a discussion of proration for the month of September 2011, right?
That's correct.
But it would have been legally impossible for the effective date to occur before the end of September 2011, correct?
Correct. The effective date has not even occurred to this day.
Right. But I'm saying it would have been at the time the approval date came, it was legally impossible for the effective date to have come before the end of 2011, right?
The BLM could have.
No, I'm not talking about. I'm not even talking about the BLM condition. There was a zoning condition, right?
Correct.
And the zoning condition required not only that the zoning change be approved, but that all appeal periods had run, correct?
Correct.
And Nevada law, which we've looked at, NRS 278.315, has an appeal period of 25 days.
Okay.
And so it was legally impossible because September 11th plus 25 days takes you past September 30th, right?
That's correct.
So what you're telling us is that this rent provision, which specifically discusses prorating rent for the partial month of September, was a nullity from the start that couldn't possibly have gone into effect, but you're still arguing that the lease is unambiguous, that the rent didn't start till the effective date.
No, that's not what we're arguing.
Okay.
We're arguing that the parties to this contract, by the way, plaintiff, the United States government, is not a party.
Yeah, I understand.
The parties to this contract did something creative, which is they said, if the conditions precedent are met at some point in the future and the effective date happens, we want these ground rent payments to begin and effectively backdate to the approval date. And they, if you read on in the rest of the last paragraph of Section 1.6.2.1, it sets out exactly what happens in the event that the effective date never comes, which is no credit or refund for those provisional payments will be made.
But under your construction, wouldn't that mean that the effective date has to occur before any rent is owed, and then once the effective date occurs, there's a retroactive payment back to the approval date? Is that what you're arguing?
The parties could have done it that way, but the way they actually did it was to say, go ahead and start paying, and that there will be no credit or refund for the ground rent paid under this section 1.6.2.1 due to the company.
But
so it, the risk
it,
of loss, if you will,
it says,
is on Nevada Links.
It says the rent, referring to the $100,000, shall begin on the approval date, prorated for the month of September, and if the effective date never comes, it reverts to the rent in the lease, which is the participatory rent. So, I understand that there is another provision that says the rental provisions don't come into effect till the effective date, but here, the rent begins, this rent, meaning the 100 grand, shall begin on the approval date, and if the effective never comes, it reverts, which I think the most logical meaning of that is it reverts to the participatory rent. So even if you have an argument that it means something else, how isn't my reading, which is the government's reading, how isn't that at least a possibility such that it needs to go to a trier of fact?
If you credit that argument, Your Honor, you find that there is an ambiguity, then that question, if it were necessary to decide, I would agree with you, would go to the trier of fact. But Chief Judge Dew's decision does not get to the question of whether or not the Fourth Amendment was or was not effective to displace the participatory
rent. Okay, your first argument is the statute of limitations.
Yes.
But what I don't understand is how can the statute of limitations begin running before there's a breach. I mean, the government has said participatory rent's not a breach. The only breach is the new 100 grand rent term. And at the very earliest, that was effective September 11th. I am totally at sea as to how the statute of limitations for a breach of contract can start running before there's a breach.
Yeah, so I think first there's the plaintiff doesn't get to zoom in on only part of the circumstances and ignore the totality of the circumstances in deciding what conduct it wants to be the breach, as opposed to what the accrual inquiry is.
Why not? Why not? I mean, the Fourth Amendment could have started a new clock. Maybe they were in breach for the $0 payments that happened prior to that, but why did anyone have to call that, and no one did?
Because even under the government's position, the Fourth Amendment increased the proceeds that it was receiving. It's not a new and discrete injury.
No,
that's
the rent. It increased the proceeds, but a percentage lease that produces nothing because there's no net to apply the percentage to can still be, at the time it was made, an agreement for a much higher rent because the parties anticipate much more net revenue. And that's what happened here, evidently. So it can be a higher rent, it can be a lower rent, it can be an approximation. What's important is whether it's a different rent and whether it went into effect, because that would start the clock running.
Yeah, so two responses there, Judge Kleinfeld. I think first we would say we think the district court got it right, that the injury the United States is alleging is...
You understand we have to review de novo.
Right, absolutely. But that the injury, and I'll get to the second point in just a second, that the injury is the alleged failure to lease or otherwise convey the property for fair market rent, and that they had a reasonable notice of that long before the parties proposed the Fourth Amendment. But the second...
I don't see how they could have reasonable notice before the Fourth Amendment went into effect.
Because the...
They could have reasonable notice that there might be a breach coming, but there couldn't be a breach till it went into effect.
Well, they're suing under the deed and the subsequent memorandum agreement. They're not suing under the Fourth Amendment. So the breach is...
Oh, I think the government would disagree with you on that. I think the government would say they're suing on the entire lease, but the breach was of the Fourth Amendment.
That's what they're arguing. But I'm saying that the contracts that they're alleging that the defendants breached were in existence long before the Fourth Amendment?
I'm not sure that's true. The way the statute is worded, it runs from the time of a lease for less than fair market value rent. And such a lease would not be made until the Fourth Amendment became effective. Talk, agreement to make a lease in the future, all that is not the same thing.
I respectfully disagree. I think the lease here, the conveyance of the property, giving the leasehold interest to Nevada Links, occurred in 1999.
Oh, yeah, but that's the old lease, and the government didn't think it was a breach. Say, help me on something else. I don't want either of us to forget about it. Give me your interpretation of this letter that said excerpts of record 336, May 24, 2016, the one where the county writes to the government and closed as a payment of $147,000 and so forth. What does that letter mean and say?
Yep.
I'm trying to find out whether there's a waiver of the condition precedent.
Right. So I don't think it's a waiver. I think it's the reality of exactly how the parties creatively set up this condition precedent and payment scheme to work, which is the payments would begin. And remember, under SNPLMA and the deed, there's an obligation to
I don't
convey
think I made
property,
my question clear. I don't think I made my question clear, so let me tell you what's on my mind, and you can educate me. The way I understood the 99 lease, or rather the way I understood the, I guess probably both, but the way I understood the Fourth Amendment was there are various conditions precedent. One of the conditions precedent is that the government approve whatever deal the county and the golf course make. Now, if that condition precedent prevents the formation of a new contract, then the Fourth Amendment never goes into effect and there's never any breach, I don't suppose. But if that condition precedent of approval has somehow disappeared through waiver or anything else, then putting the Fourth Amendment into effect could be a new lease, a novation, and a new breach. And I'm trying to figure out whether this letter means that the county concedes, as the government contends, that the condition precedent has in fact been waived.
No, we don't concede that. In order to prove waiver, contract modification or waiver, the plaintiff must meet its burden by clear and convincing evidence. We think, given the way the Fourth Amendment was structured, where the payments began before the effective date, and that the that where I was going is that the county is required under SNPLM and the deed to remit 85% of gross proceeds, regardless of whether it's below, above, or at fair market value. And so it's perfectly natural for the county to be remitting the proceeds of these provisional payments that it, that were being made. They were required to do that. The other thing I want to point out is that Board of County Commissioner approval would be have been required.
Well, tell me about the words, though. This
one individual employee can't do it by letter or otherwise.
Tell me about the words of this letter. It says that the county and the golf course have renegotiated the payment terms, and it says that the remaining terms become operative upon approval of the Fourth Amendment. And I'm trying to understand whether that means that despite the government's not having approved it, the county concedes that the Fourth Amendment is in effect.
No, the county does not concede that, and this letter expressly references the conditions preceding. But then the intent is that we also have been receiving these payments while we wait to see if they can be met, and we're remitting the SNPLM portion of those payments as we're required to do.
So you think that letter was immaterial? You think it just summarized the reality of what was happening?
Yes, I do. It could have been worded better.
Better for you.
It was written by a non-lawyer. But
isn't that even better? I mean, look, this is arguably an admission by somebody who's charged with administering the contract. I understand the board didn't approve that construction, but your line officers who were dealing with it, they read it the same way as the government did.
I disagree with that reading of the letter, because the proceeds that were, the payments that were coming in, there was an obligation to remit proceeds. And I don't think that this letter, as inartfully worded as it may be, proves by clear and convincing evidence that the county government waived the conditions preceding.
Let's assume we agree there's an ambiguity as to the effective date versus the approval date. And you've neutralized this letter from the county manager, whoever he was that wrote that. Let's assume that. Are there any facts that suggest here that it should be read, any parole evidence other than the reading of the contract itself that suggests that it should be read your way?
Yes. Nevada Links continued to submit financial statements to the county to evaluate whether or not there was any net revenue as calculated per the lease. And it's not in the record, but my understanding is that the provisional payments have stopped more than 2 years ago, so they're no longer being made. Your Honor. I notice my time is almost up. I would just like to add that the government's position with respect to the statute of limitations, when taken to its necessary conclusion, means that the only way for the county, despite with the conditions precedent trying to avoid this predicament, the only way for the county to have avoided the specter of litigation or liability would have been to remain trapped in a non-performing lease for a half century, if not even a whole century. And the minute the county tried to mitigate the bad economic situation that resulted, the United States claims a new injury and they get to pounce. Not within 6 years, but at any point. The Fourth Amendment could have been executed 75 years.
What's the matter with that? I mean, you make a lease for 50 years. It turns out to be unsuccessful in producing revenue. But a deal's a deal. What's the matter with it having turned into a sour deal?
Because the statute of limitations and the purpose behind it is 6 years, and it's, particularly in the real property context, it's to remove the cloud of litigation so property can be put to a higher and better use. which will benefit everybody, including, ironically, the plaintiff here, the United States government.
Then why do you think they're taking this position? That they're just not really, they don't know what's for their own good?
I think they disagree, obviously, with us that the participatory rent provision is still in effect, and their position is that the conditions preceding have been waived, and so that the $100,000 is the only thing remaining. But the county doesn't agree with that, and neither does my colleague, Mr. Schoenberg, for Nevada Links. The parties to the contract both agree the participatory rent provision is still in effect.
Well, that's why I think maybe you in the United States ought to give some thought to talking if it looks like this case is heading back to the district court. But we have your argument. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. Tony Schoenberg for the respondent, Nevada Links. My client's only sued on the breach of fiduciary duty claim, not on the breach of contract claim, so I'm going to limit my comments to that. First, Your Honors, I did want to mention, in the discussion of statute of limitations, I haven't heard anyone talk about inquiry notice. Inquiry notice is not a high bar. The Ninth Circuit has said that, quote, accrual does not wait until the injured party has access to or constructive knowledge of all the facts required to support its claim.
But doesn't that just mean that if the United States had sued saying this zero payment, this zero participatory rent, that's a breach? If they had sued on that basis, then I think you'd be right. But they haven't sued on that basis.
Well, I think they've artificially tried to limit their claim to just challenging the Fourth Amendment because of their concern about the statute of limitations. Certainly seems that way.
But counsel, let's assume that that's a fair reading of what the United States has done. Mm-hmm. Why can't they limit what their claim is for breach? I mean, isn't it good for the defendants, for the United States to say everything up until September 2011, no breach, and all we want is going forward? I mean, They could have theoretically said, you know, there was stuff we weren't told, there was stuff we didn't know, so the discovery rule, et cetera. But, I mean, in the abstract, isn't it not so bad that the United States is saying you paid us zero for whatever, how many, 12 years or whatever it is, and we don't get anything for that period?
Well, I think the U.S. has to limit or has to live with the consequence of its decision to limit its claim in that way.
Yeah, sure. The limit is they don't get to cancel the county's ownership of the property. They don't get the property back until there's a breach of the Fourth Amendment.
Well, if you accept the U.S.'s premise that $100,000 per year is unequivocally less than fair market value, regardless of the underlying economics, and that is the U.S.'s position, then it necessarily follows that the U.S. was at least on inquiry notice of its alleged injury, that is, that the county was collecting less than fair market value, when the U.S. learned
the statute doesn't talk about what the U.S. is collecting. It talks about when it enters into a lease. The statute says the county can't lease the land for less than fair market value. It doesn't say that the county can't collect less than fair market value. Fair market value is often a percentage lease.
Well, under the inquiry notice standard, the U.S. was at least on notice of its potential injury related to that fair market value standard when its employees learned as early as 2004 that $0 was being collected.
But isn't it possible that $0 could be the right amount not paid because the parties to the lease are actually expecting that this property will be, you know, something will happen to it that will give it new value, and then the money will start to really flow in a big way to accommodate all those 0 years?
That's possible. I'm not saying that that's not possible. But if you accept the U.S.'s premise that $100,000 is necessarily less than fair market value, then the necessary consequence is that zero is also less than fair market value.
But it's $100,000 forever. It's not 100,000 from 2011 to 2012, the way the United States is reading the lease, and it strikes me as a fair reading of the Fourth Amendment. It's 100,000 forever, not 100,000 plus participatory rent, but 100,000 forever. And that's their argument, that 100,000 forever is less, is a violative of the MOA.
Well, my time is running short, so I do want to make a couple more points, Your Honors. One is that the U.S. is seeking to apply an accrual standard for the breach of fiduciary duty claim that is incorrect. The accrual standard is not a repudiation-based standard. The Jones line of cases makes that clear. And the U.S. really hasn't tried to distinguish those cases other than to say that they're from the Court of Claims and that the U.S. was the defendant instead of the plaintiff in those claims.
They're just not suing on the claim that you say they're suing on. They're characterizing it as a different claim. It's not for the participatory rent. It's that the fixed rent was noncompliant.
No, I understand. But either way, repudiation is not the standard for accrual of a breach of fiduciary duty claim.
Hmm.
And that's the Jones line of cases makes that clear, that repudiation is only the accrual standard in the circumstance where the trust corpus is the subject of the claim. Otherwise, you follow the general rules of accrual. And for the reasons that we've stated, we believe that those rules of accrual do lead to the conclusion that the statute of limitations has expired. My time is running over, I know. I want to just say one last thing.
That's fine, counsel. Go ahead.
Okay. We did not intend to suggest that we disagree with the county's interpretation of the lease amendment in our papers. And so if somehow that impression was conveyed, it was mistaken. We are on board with the county's interpretation. Actually, my client is no longer paying the $100,000 per year. I stopped paying that some time ago.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
All right, Mr. Schultz, we'll give you 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to go back to Judge Kogan's question about whether there's any factual disputes in the extrinsic evidence, because I think the county is pointing to the fact that they were still getting financial statements even while the Fourth Amendment's new rent was in effect. If you go to the reply brief, the government's reply brief, this is page 21. There's a paragraph where we deal with that that piece of evidence. And if you read the deposition transcript, that witness goes on to explain that the reason the county was still getting the financial statements was because they were consulting with outside counsel about what the effect was of the Fourth Amendment. And so one of the employees goes to their boss and they say, you know, hey, should we still be getting these statements? And the boss basically says, well, while we sort it out, keep getting these statements, but treat the Fourth Amendment like it's in effect. So I don't think that creates any factual dispute there.
Did the Fourth Amendment also, in any way obliterate or obviate the need to send financial statements? I didn't see anything that says you know, this provision of the original lease is withdrawn.
I think once the effective date happened, then the obligation to send financial statements may have ceased, but there was no provision that ceased the obligation to send financial statements before the effective date, as far as I'm aware. I also want to just briefly talk about the idea that this might have been a participatory rent plus the $100,000 rent. That's not how we read it, and we've explained that in our brief. But I also want to point out that even if the court thinks that that was the effect of the Fourth Amendment, whether or not that constitutes a breach is a complicated question. And that's because the Fourth Amendment wasn't just changing the rent. It was also attempting to convey very valuable additional development rights. And so in light of that, you would have to assess, I suppose, whether that participatory rent plus the $100,000 rent, based on the information known as of September 2011, was equal to the value of whatever was being conveyed. I don't know that that's fully answered by the record that's on appeal.
I'm sorry, counsel, did you make that specific argument to the district court, the one you just made?
For purposes of summary judgment, we did not make that argument. And my point is only that if the court thinks that it's relevant for breach to know whether or not the participatory rent is in effect along with the additional rent, it starts to become a much more complicated issue. But again, at a minimum, we think that it is ambiguous whether or not the participatory rent coexisted with the $100,000 rent. And frankly, we think the contract's terms are clear that the $100,000 rent supplanted the participatory rent. And that indeed was the effect of the estoppel certificate that Nevada Links and the county jointly recorded. I'd be happy to answer any other questions, but otherwise we would ask this court to reverse and send the case back for further proceedings.
All right. Thank you. We thank counsel for their helpful arguments, and the case just argued is submitted.